joining me for the Yesterlife show. My name's Robin Daly and I'm chairman of Yesterlife, the UK's integrative cancer care charity. For the last decade, we've been helping people with cancer to build their own integrative programs of care, drawing from the widest possible range of options available in both conventional and complementary and alternative medicine. One piece of advice you'll often see in integrative circles is to build yourself a team to support you through treatment. Individuals may make very different choices as to who to co-opt onto their team, but one option many people do decide on is to use a medical herbalist, both during and after conventional treatment, or indeed if they're taking an entirely unconventional route. Today I'm talking to a medical herbalist who has made a speciality of supporting people with cancer, Dr. Chris Etheridge. Good afternoon, Chris. Thanks very much for coming on the Yesterlife show. So you've got a background in what might be described as the hard sciences of genetics and chemistry. It seems like an unlikely, although probably excellent, springboard for a career in a discipline considered as traditional medicine, as a medical herbalist. So what prompted you to make the leap into the world of herbs as medicine?
Thank you, Robin. I guess, you know, having trained in chemistry and biochemistry and then the medical side of things, and then working in cancer genetics at Imperial College and Paddington, the hospital there, I kind of got a bit disillusioned with how things were going with the medical services and the NHS generally, and really thought I needed to do something that was going to help patients a bit more. So I said, looked around, decided over a couple of years that I really need to move out of the more orthodox area and look at something a bit more holistic. So I decided, after sort of much soul searching and wallet searching, to embark on a 4-year degree in herbal medicine at College of Phytotherapy, which is the best course in the UK. And you know, and kind of have a look back since then. I mean, I've always been fascinated by herbs and natural compounds since a young boy, when my grandmother used to take me around her garden and show me all the different herbs that she used in her kitchen and for healing and things. Mm. So I kind of have that kind of apprenticeship there, so to say. So okay. That was kind of what got me into chemistry in the first place, and lo and behold, that actually got me into herbal medicine sort of full-time in the end.
Right, circuitous route, interesting, yeah. So you describe yourself as a medical herbalist. Can you just explain what makes a medical herbalist as opposed to a plain old herbalist?
Well, with medical herbalists, we're fully trained. It's a 4-year BSc ONS, and we're trained in not only herbal medicine, but in the full medical side of things as well. And I must say, it's the most intensive and difficult degree I've ever done. Wow. Compared to anything else I ever did, any of my degrees or other degrees or PhDs, it was the most demanding. It was hard work. Mm. And you know, it went into a lot of detail into all the medical side of things. So it's very much like a medical degree, plus the herbal medicine side of things, plus botany, plus a few other things as well. So it was kind of shoving everything into a very sort of limited time period. 4 years sounds a long time, but it wasn't, particularly when we had to do 500 hours of clinical practice as well, which took up a lot of the time. Mm. So it was very, very, very intensive.
Mm, interesting. Okay, so how much do you feel your background in biochemistry, genetics, informs your day-to-day practice with herbs? Are there any ways in which you feel that your approach may be different from other more traditionally based herbs as a result?
Well, I mean, I with my training and love and work in research, I do tend to look a lot at the research behind the herbs, because, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people will say, okay, well, herbal medicine, not much evidence for it. And actually, if you look at it, there's actually quite a lot of evidence out there for herbal medicines, various ones, you know, in use of things like St. John's wort, ginkgo, valerian. There's actually some very, very good research. It's perhaps not the gold standard research that the conventional medics want, which are the randomised controlled placebo trials, because they're just too expensive to do. There's not much money in the alternative side, as we know, whereas, of course, the big pharmaceutical companies have millions and billions they can throw into research. Yes, so you know, there is research, and I find that's really important to my practice. I do tend to look at the research and change my dispensing, my prescriptions, according to the research that's coming through. So, I mean, I think my training in chemistry and biochemistry is absolutely invaluable. And I wouldn't change the career path I've actually had, because I think it puts me in a very sort of interesting position. And, you know, I'm always finding my chemistry and biochemistry useful, both for meetings and for talks and in practice as well.
Mm. Unusually, I'd say, for a herbalist, you've decided to focus on supporting people with cancer. But how much has that got to do with your genetic study and all the rest of it? What led you to?
Well, I mean, when I was doing my work at St Mary's Hospital, I was doing quite a lot there with cancer genetics. So I've always had an interest in that area. But then after that, I did some work with Dr. Rosie Daniel on her health creation booklet on cancer, and then went to work with Patricia Pete at Cancer Options for a number of years. So I think, you know, cancer's always been my main interest, I would say, back from my sort of undergraduate days, I would say.
Mm-hmm. But let's talk a bit about herbs and cancer. How important do you feel a herbalist can be as part of a cancer support team?
I think that they can really be an invaluable part of a support team, because there is so much that can be done with herbal medicine to support conventional treatments. We can really work on reducing side effects, helping the immune system during procedures like chemotherapy, radiotherapy, helping to allay some of the symptoms caused by hormone therapies, helping recovery after surgery, etc., etc. And of course, you know, I think there's a lot we can do to aid recovery post-treatment and help keep the patient in a healthy place so they don't have a risk of cancer again or developing other cancers in the future. So, you know, I think, you know, prevention is very, very important, but I think we can do a lot to support as well. And I think that's where I see my role really is supporting patients who are undergoing conventional chemotherapy, radiotherapy, etc.
So you would sort of label it as a good integrative treatment, to put in the mix.
Yeah, I mean, I see myself as an integrated cancer specialist.
Okay. So, on the other side, do you find that some people have unrealistic expectations for the role of herbs in cancer?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you can read a lot of things on the internet that suggest that, you know, every week you can see something that a miracle cure for cancer and another tree bark, that if you take this, your cancer will be cured. And of course, it's a load of hocus pocus. There are good research for some of these things, but sometimes they only work in the test tube. Sometimes they don't work in humans. Sometimes they do, but not always. So I think, you know, there are people who come to me with very advanced cancer. They've been told it's terminal cancer. They have been told there's nothing else to be done for them, and they expect, you know, me to do something with herbal medicine to cure them. And sadly, that's really not always possible. There's a lot we can do to palliate, to help pain, to help quality of life, to help sustain life. But, you know, in many cases, with very advanced cancers, as you'll know, there's really nothing that can be done either conventionally or alternatively either.
So let's talk a little bit about safety, because, of course, it's a very important aspect of any medical intervention. But we regularly hear in the tabloids dire warnings about the dangers of herbs, you know. how does this all stack up from the point of view of a medical herbalist?
Well, I mean, firstly, I should say that a lot of the training we have, medical training, is about pharmacology. So the interaction of herbs with the body, herbs and drugs together as well in the body. So we're all very, very, very keenly aware that issues are possible. So, you know, we have databases that have all the latest research on any potential interactions, both in a herb drug or herb supplement, etc., interactions. So that's something that I keep very much on top of, because it's important. And there are many herbs you cannot use. For example, herbs like St. John's wort, we probably all know, interacts with lots of medicines and can affect sort of chemotherapy, etc. So one has to be very, very careful. So yeah, I think herbs are generally safe to use in treatments like chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and can actually really have some benefits. Things like, you know, turmeric have been shown to improve the outcomes of radiotherapy, for example. But counterwise, turmeric can actually interfere with some chemotherapy agents such as cyclophosphamide. So, you know, it's not fair to say that one, just because one herb has a good anti-cancer property and is good for some things, it should be used for all cancers or for all treatments. So that's when I think it's necessary that, rather than self-medicating, that patients see a herbalist, a naturopath, or somebody similar who actually knows about these things. Quite frankly, I'll be honest with you, most medical doctors and nurses don't know anything at all about herbs or supplements. They have no training in that area. And, you know, they're so busy with their own knowledge area, they haven't got time to research into these areas. So often they are quite dismissive and say, don't take anything, which is a shame, because often there are things that can be helpful, as I said. Or also, they often refer to the university pharmacy departments, which, though they are very, very good, can be inconsistent. So you have different pharmacy departments telling patients different things for the same supplement. So it gets very, very confusing. Some saying that it's allowed, some saying it's not allowed. So it can leave patients in a very sort of vulnerable sort of state. They're not quite sure if what they're doing is helpful or harming, which I think you need a professional intervention there to make sure that things can be double-checked.
Yeah, it's a horrible position to be in, that one, and you're right. As with most things in the whole world of cancer and integrative medicine, expert advice is nearly always a good idea, because it's always a lot more complicated than you thought.
always, absolutely, Robin, yes.
Yeah. You talked about three areas, really, in which you're saying that you think it can be helpful, which is actually going through conventional treatment, dealing with the conventional treatment itself and trying to make that less damaging, more effective, less painful, and then recovering full health afterwards, and then staying well. The staying well aspect is probably one of the most important aspects here, because it seems that conventional medicine can put you in a place quite often where it appears that you're cured, but that doesn't mean to say you're not going to have a recurrence 9 months later. So this is, you know, a huge section of the statistics of cancer deaths are actually people who've got secondaries and then die. Yeah. After successful first treatment. Maybe can you say a bit more about how herbs can help with that?
Well, I think from what you're saying, I totally agree. I think it's very important to change the environment that let the cancer develop in the first place. Because obviously, even though there's triggers for cancer, which can be chemical or radiation or viral causes, you know, for a normal cell to become a cancerous cell, there's a number of different changes, six different steps that have to happen, occur sequentially in order for that changes to occur, for a cancerous cell to become viable and able to spread. You know, and usually the last step in that is when the immune system becomes bogged down by stress, anxiety, poor sleep, you know, unfortunately things we see every day in modern westernised life, and with poor diet, etc. as well. So I think, you know, there's so much that can be done to create an environment that's hostile to cancer. So, you know, just simple things like reducing dairy intake, cutting out red meat intake, eating well, balanced diet, plenty of vegetables, not too much sugar, plenty of protein, reducing stress levels, you know, just on that level. But of course, there are lots of herbs that can actually help with that. So herbs to help the body deal with stress and anxiety. There's a class of herbs called adaptogens, right, which help the body adapt to stress. So well-known herbs like the ginsengs, and less well-known herbs like the Indian herb ashwagandha, and Chinese herbs such as milkfetch, astragalus. So these can really help to deal with the stress process in the body and make the body more robust, and meaning the immune system isn't so compromised by stress. And of course, we have the immunomodulator herbs as well. So well-known ones, again, like, you know, astragalus, echinacea, which help to boost the immune system, or balance it, I should say, rather than boost it, which helps the normal immunosurveillance happen, the process where the body actually patrols, targets, and kills cancer cells as they develop or spread. And as on top of that, we can work on detoxification, because most people don't generally digest very well these days. We live in such stressed times when we're eating quickly, often eating poorly. Our poor liver, our poor digestive tract is in a terrible state. It's coming to light more and more that the microbiome, so the bacteria in the gut, are an important part of our body, both for controlling anything from diabetes to high blood pressure, but also to the immune system. With 80% of the immune system is based around the gut. So if the gut is in balance, the immune system is not working properly. So there are many, many herbs that are very gentle and healing on the gut. So herbs like calendula, for example, and centella. And there are also so-called prebiotic herbs. So these are herbs that actually supply food for the good bacteria. So things like slippery elm, chicory root, artichoke root, etc. These can all really, really help on top of using supplements such as probiotics, you know, etc. as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and how about sleep? Are there herbs that can actually help people? I mean, a lot of people do have a lot of trouble with sleep, and of course that's a major sort of undermining factor, isn't it?
Oh, totally. I mean, and there's so many studies. If you look at the population of the white blood cells that tend to fight cancer, which are called natural killer cells, if you see, as soon as somebody becomes sleep deprived, the level of these natural killer cells in the bloodstream go rapidly down to very, very low levels. Mm. So, you know, sleep, yeah, lack of sleep is a huge problem. And, you know, if we think that nowadays we're sleeping generally 1 hour less than we were 100 years ago, it has a huge impact on our body, on our immune system, and on our ability to actually deal with stress. But there are many, many herbs that are very, very useful. Herbs like valerian, passion flower, very, very calming, relaxing herbs. They're, you know, people always a bit worried when I suggest these herbs because we think of them as herbal sedatives. They are very calming and they will make you sleepy, but they'll only make you sleepy if you're tired. So you can actually take them during the daytime and you'll just feel relaxed and be able to work very, very well. Right. But you'll find towards the evening time, you'll become more tired and you'll go to sleep more easily and go into a deeper sleep with more REM sleep, so much more relaxing, calming, healing sleep.
Interesting. So those six stages that you had to move through in order to get to a stage where you're actually, you know, cells will start to become cancerous, are you able to describe those in terms we're going to understand? They're not sort of major biochemistry?
Well, it depends very much on the different cancer. I mean, I think it's becoming more and more obvious as research goes along that the viruses are probably a trigger in many cancers. You know, because cancers, as we know, tend to be caused by mutations in the DNA, the genetic code. How viruses work is that when they infect cells, they tend to break open our genetic code and insert themselves into it, often at random places. And this can either turn off our normal anti-tumour genes in the body, or it can activate pro-cancer genes in the body. So, you know, there's certainly a lot of evidence for different things like the Epstein-Barr virus being involved with leukemias, and mouth and throat cancers. And I think as more research goes along, we'll find more and more viruses are involved. Obviously, there's other factors as well. There's genetic issues. Some people have a predisposed history to cancer, family history. Some people have a congenital risk of cancer, just a random thing that's happened when they were conceived that means a gene slightly damaged so that the normal repair systems don't work properly. And of course, I think, you know, we've mentioned, you know, lack of sleep, stress, poor work situations, emotional stresses, poor diet. These again all tend to increase inflammation in the body. And again, there's a lot of evidence now backing up that unregulated chronic inflammation is certainly a cause and certainly something that drives cancer as well. So anything we can do sort of to deal with inflammation in the body is also really, really important as well. But, you know, I think those are probably the main causes of cancer in most people today. Obviously, there are other causes. Radiation from people who work in nuclear power stations, that's lucky not many of the population.
Yeah.
And, you know, chemical damage, UV radiation and skin cancer, for example, as well. These are all different things. But I think mainly we're looking at dealing with problems with the westernised lifestyle, quite frankly. They're the main cause.
Right, okay. Something I read about quite often is that attempts to isolate active compounds from natural remedies can be successful to an extent, but they're seldom as effective as a whole plant remedy. leading to the conclusion that kind of the synergy of everything that's in a plant, it works in a much more complex way than we understand as yet, and therefore is able to do more. I mean, do you want to talk about that a little bit, or what's your experience?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think synergy is a vital, vital part of herbal medicine. You know, the sum of the different parts is greater than you'd expect. So, you know, that's why in herbal medicine prescriptions, we don't just use one herb. We tend to use four or five different herbs, which often have similar overlaps, because you do get this real synergy where you get a major effect, much, much, much greater than you'd expect from the different herbs alone. I think one of the errors that we do is to try and investigate the herbs in too much detail. So we look at them, we see they work, and then the pharmaceutical companies or researchers try and identify what the active compounds are. Yeah. And as you said, often they find one most active compound, which they then isolate, dig out, and replicate, change, and put on the market as a chemotherapy drug. I mean, think sort of 80% of current chemotherapy drugs are based on plant compounds. And as we know, that's when they start to become toxic and with side effects. And often as you look into more detail, you find there are other compounds within the herb that actually naturally mitigate those side effects. So as a combination, it works well with very, very few side effects. But as soon as you take away some of those mediating, calming sort of factors, then things start to become far more dangerous and the side effects become far more intense. And that's really my worry with herbs such as turmeric. Turmeric has a lot of research on it. And certainly if you look up on the internet, you'll find there are lots of trials, phase 2, phase 3 clinical trials being undertaken in the US at the moment, which is brilliant because turmeric does work extremely well on many different cancer types. But the worry is that, of course, the researchers are currently trying to extract the active compound curcumin and find better forms of it. And they probably will find forms that work better in a test tube. But of course, the problem is then when they start using this as a chemotherapy agent, you'll find there'll be side effects that cause other issues, when obviously it's better to use the turmeric itself. Of course, the issue is purely a financial one. You can't patent a natural medicine, but of course you can patent a changed medicine, a synthetic medicine. Mm. So that's what the driving force is.
Yeah, which shows there's a direct conflict between financial interest and actually patient interest there, because what works best doesn't make the money.
Well, absolutely. And that's always my concern. You know, even though I think there's quite honestly, a time and a place for chemotherapy, I do think in some cases it is used when it's not necessary. Mm. I mean, I think I read some figure recently that the average cancer patient in the UK was worth £80,000 to the pharmaceutical industry, which I quite believe when it comes to the chemotherapy drugs and support drugs, anti-nausea drugs. Yeah. And so there is, in my opinion, a certain drive to push patients down a certain route, even if it's not the best one for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, something a bit left field now. there's a kind of notion that things that are native to the place where somebody comes from are somehow more likely to be a benefit to them than some foreign species. Is that something you've got any experience or understanding of, or you think that's rubbish?
I don't think it's rubbish at all, no. I think, you know, certainly when you look at the ethnobotanical use of herbs, they do seem to work, you know, better in certain ethnic populations.
You're right.
And, you know, certainly that's been shown in conventional cancer treatments with epigenetics. Some chemotherapy drugs work very well in some subpopulations, but not in others.
Oh, really?
And so I think the same thing does apply to herbal medicines. You know, I personally try and use native herbs as much as possible in my practice. There are some, though, that there's a great deal of research for that do work in a wide range of people. So, you know, I couldn't, if I just used native herbs, I couldn't have access to things like ginger or turmeric or passion flower or some of the American herbs like black cohosh or echinacea, which are sort of key parts of my dispensary. But, you know, I do use a lot of herbs like calendula, which has a very underrated, you know, cancer activity, but actually works very, very well and is kind of comparative to echinacea in many of its activities. So yeah, I do try and use natives when I can, and I try and use natively sourced material when I can as well in my dispensary. That's not always possible, unfortunately.
Mm. Okay. So integrative medicine has kind of expanded awareness of traditional approaches internationally. We're all much more aware of what's going on around the planet. How much effect do you think other traditions, like the Chinese use of herbs, for example, how much effect has that had on herbalism in Europe and the UK?
Oh, a huge effect, I think. There's also with China, particularly Chinese medicine, there's a phenomenal amount of research that's carried out in China. Some of it's not very good research, to be honest, but there is some research that's very, very good indeed. So it certainly does influence, my practice. I use a number of herbs that were primarily used solely in traditional Chinese medicine. The same way with Ayurvedic medicine as well. There's a number of herbs there that are very, very, very key. That really interesting research that I use in my practice. I mean, things like ashwagandha, which is a wonderful adaptogen and immune tonic, and it's very helpful during chemotherapy and radiotherapy. It's an absolute herb that I use, routinely every day in my practice, and I couldn't do without it. And I think most practitioners in the UK, though our tradition is originally using sort of European herbs, with the use of the herbs in the United States, particularly of America and America generally, but also from the Chinese tradition, from the Ayurvedic tradition, from the Tibetan tradition, etc. We have kind of cherry picked the good herbs out of those that we consider to be good herbs and brought them into our pharmacopoeia. So if you look at our Materia Medica now, I probably use about 300 herbs in my practice. And I would say probably about 100 of them come from Chinese, Tibetan, and Ayurvedic traditions, and probably another 100 of those from the North American traditions.
So it's interesting. So in a way, there's a kind of new discipline emerging, a sort of international herbalism, which draws on all of them.
Well, absolutely, yeah. And there's a lot of research kind of going on with herbs in Africa, for example, because obviously there's a huge use or past use of traditional medicines in Africa with some phenomenal results. That tradition was lost, I think, a little bit when westernization occurred, with tribes, populations being told to use Western medicines, they're better. And then, of course, unfortunately, they're expensive, so the tribes couldn't actually afford them a lot of the time, and then had to fall back onto trying to remember what the actual medicines that they used before were. And there's a lot of testing being done now with some very interesting results. Some very interesting results with some Nigerian herbs with anti-cancer properties, etc. That's really, very fascinating. So I think, as time goes by, more research is carried out, we will actually identify more of these herbs with interesting and useful properties, and they'll be absorbed into the pharmacopoeia of the UK.
And do you know who's driving the research into things like that? Is it the interest of orthodox medicine in finding out what they use in Africa, or is it herbalists?
In some cases, herbalists. Mostly, it's researchers who are looking to find a new compound that can then be sold on to a drug company for development further, because that's where the big money is, unfortunately. Sure. So it's all financially driven.
But there are benefits to herbalists as well, because they get to find out about these things at the same time.
Absolutely. And a lot of the research, is a side benefit from conventional research. So yeah. Any research is useful.
So I believe that while you set great store, obviously, in the power of herbs to support health, you also do use supplements. And what guides your choice between herbs and supplements when you're working to, say, support someone with cancer?
Well, with some herbs, you need them in very, very high doses. And though you could do that using herbal teas or tinctures, etc., you'd need to take sort of huge heroic doses of them. So herbs like turmeric, boswellia, frankincense, which are two key herbs, I tend to use as supplements, just because you can buy very easily concentrated extracts of them, which, for example, if you get a good quality turmeric capsule or tablet, one of those is equivalent to about 5 grams of turmeric spice, because you need about sort of at least 15 grams of turmeric spice per day over the whole day in order to have an anti-cancer problem. Yeah, you couldn't have that in a curry. It'd be awful. I think in those cases, a stronger supplement is needed to get the actual dose you need to have a therapeutic effect. And, you know, in my practice, it's about herbs predominantly, yes, but it's also about nutrition, because, you know, diet and nutrition are the foundation stone for any treatment. If the diet is not good, no other treatment, be it conventional, be it herbal medicine, will work as well, because the body just is not able to heal itself if the material going into it is not suitable to actually sustain and maintain it. So I take big steps to make sure that diet is addressed, to make sure that the diet is healthy, to make sure lifestyle is healthy as well. And I think that's absolutely key. And on top of that, there are some supplements I think that are really useful for patients, just to help boost them, particularly with things like chemotherapy, when the digestive tract is very irritated and inflamed, things like, you know, vitamins and minerals may be necessary during those sort of procedures. And often as well, making sure patients have levels of essential vitamins like vitamin D3. We know now that a lot of cancer patients are deficient in vitamin D3. I would say 99.9% of patients I test are deficient. And I think it's essential for the immune system in order to get the vitamin D3 levels back up as much as possible. And that's actually hard to do with diet. And in those cases, you do need a very high strength supplement.
Given. Or a good holiday.
Sorry?
Or a good holiday.
Or a good holiday in the sun, yes, with plenty of oily fish. Yes, absolutely, yes.
Yeah. All right, well, just referring back to some things that we were talking about earlier, in the case of supplements, they kind of, to me, there are like two types of supplements. One of them works along the principle of kind of concentrating, as you spoke, things that you could eat in order that you can take a lot more of them at one go. The other ones are more like a pharmaceutical in as much as they try to isolate something and produce it as a supplement, as a separate patented maybe medicine. Do you have a sort of preference between these? Do you lean towards the whole food kind of supplements or do you find the other useful as well?
No, I would always go to the whole food things. I think otherwise, as I said before, if you start to concentrate on just one compound from the herb, you risk A, it not working very well, and B, side effects coming on. So I prefer something that's naturally extracted. So even things like the turmeric, which is concentrated, it's still a concentrated extract of all the compounds in turmeric, not just the active compound, curcumin, for example.
Right.
So it gives the whole balancing picture. And yet all of the supplements I use in my practice are very much that way, whole food derived.
It's interesting because, you know, on the face of it, you might be hard-pressed to see a reason for choosing, you know, a very particular brand of supplement on the basis of the fact that it's made from whole foods. Mm-hmm. But actually, they're in the minority, aren't they? Most of the supplements are extracts, aren't they, or isolates.
Isolates, yeah.
Now
I think it's a very tricky area, supplements, because, you know, you'd think obviously you'd avoid the cheaper supplements because they're probably not very good. But there's been some research recently on some checking the active compounds in a wide range of different supplements, and often some of the ones at the higher end of the market didn't contain any of the things they were supposed to contain.
Oh,
so it's a bit scary.
It is scary.
You know, that's when the THR products are good, so the traditional herbal registration products, because they're all checked and made sure, and you can buy those over the counter in high street in shops. It's the normal botanical ones are unchecked, and so it's a bit of a lottery whether you're getting exactly what you think or not in those.
Mm. And so obviously there are some reported bad effects of taking supplements which are isolates, particularly with some treatments or with some conditions. But those are much rarer with the whole food.
I would say generally, yes. I mean, obviously with taking any supplement, there's always going to be a tiny, tiny risk of an allergic effect. But that's the same for, you know, with foods as well. You know, you could have somebody take bromelain and they find they're allergic to pineapples, so they come up in a rash. But, you know, they're, it's never anything very, very dangerous, as long as you prime the patient to watch out for any problems and make sure they contact you if they find anything unusual happening. Mm. But, I mean, there's always issues. But I would say, again, generally, with the whole natural extracts, they're generally better tolerated, you know, in the majority of people. I can't think of, in my 15 years of practice with herbal medicine, I haven't come across one patient who had a serious interaction, a serious effect, a side effect at all. It's all been very minor ones that have usually disappeared after a couple of days, or were just taken off out of that herbal supplement and changed to something else instead, and it's been fine. So just kind of, I really haven't seen any major issues at all, and I don't think any of my colleagues have really, to tell the truth, as far as I know.
Well, that's a testimony. Okay, is there something you'd like to talk about particularly that we haven't covered at all?
I have a great deal of respect for herbal medicine, as you know. I think it's not, in many cases, herbal medicine alone isn't enough to help with cancer, which is why I think, you know, you need to bring in various other treatments as well, on top of the conventional ones. So that's why I think in my integrated sort of role, I advise people with things like, you know, hypothermia treatment, with vitamin C, mistletoe treatments, you know, things you don't regularly get on the NHS or suggested, but can be very, very helpful. And particularly things like hypothermia, they really do improve the outcome of many treatments with chemotherapy and radiotherapy, but also with herbs as well, because they just really gets the circulation going and gets the active compound into the area where it's needed. So it's, you know, I think we really need to concentrate as a whole profession on working together to make sure patients can actually access all the variety of treatments they need for their particular cancer, for their particular unique circumstances. Because I think that's one area where we're failing on as a nation. We tend to have a uniform, you know, tick box treatment for a particular cancer on a conveyor belt. And I think that's why we fail with a lot of our conventional cancer treatments, because they're not honed enough for the patient. We need more specific, personalised prescriptions of the patient. And I think that works, you know, with herbal medicine, because obviously we deal in a holistic way, but also with other integrated practitioners as well, you know, using the strengths that they have as well, whether it be anything from, say, from homeopathy or reflexology or naturopathy, to heat treatment, to high dose vitamin C, to Iscador, etc.
So this, of course, is a great strength of integrative medicine, is that it is kind of either supporting you from underneath or actually disabling the cancer from so many different directions simultaneously.
Yeah.
And therefore upping your chances of having some success in the long term.
I totally agree with that, and I think that's again a very key point, that, you know, to treat cancer or support with cancer, having one treatment is never enough. Because if you're just treating from one direction, the cancer will evolve and become resistant to that treatment. If you're targeting it from 4, 5, 6 different areas at the same time, using sort of different methodologies, the cancer cannot adapt to those. It's impossible. So it will slow it down, hopefully stop it in its tracks and kill it.
Right. So, and that's that sort of failure, if you like, of single approach is as true of the very latest and most expensive gene targeted therapies as it was of the first chemotherapies.
Absolutely. By themselves, they're never going to be enough. You need two other things as well. And, you know, I think gradually you'll see in orthodox medicine, more and more they are tending to use more of a mixed match of drugs. So they'll be using immunotherapy plus supportive therapy with maybe a low-dose chemotherapy to try and attack from many directions, as we said. But I still think there's a huge area that the complementary alternative side can actually add to that battle to really support and push from other angles as well to get better results.
That's right. The thing about using combinations, even in things as simple as, rather than having, you know, you're going to have your chemotherapy now and then we're going to go on to the radiotherapy, they're actually finding that if you do the things at the same time, they're better, aren't they, in many cases?
Absolutely. It's a shame there's not more money to do research on treatments like fasting before chemotherapy, because obviously there's a lot of interesting orthodox research being carried out on a very small scale. With fasting for 2 or 3 days before chemotherapy, it tends to put the immune system into a hibernation. So when you have a chemotherapy, the immune cells aren't destroyed by the chemotherapy. So when you start eating again after chemotherapy, your immune cells are able to come up quickly rather than being damaged. And, you know, it's a very, very interesting area, but it's one that unfortunately most conventional doctors don't really take seriously, even though, as I said, it is an area of conventional research. And certainly a lot of my patients I do advise to have a juice fast for sort of 72 hours before chemotherapy, and it seems to be doing a better job
than they recover quickly.
Yeah, they do, yeah, absolutely. So it doesn't actually kind of probably help the effectiveness of the chemotherapy, but it improves the side effects for the patient.
Which is, of course, a major.
Absolutely. Quality of life is as important, I think, in many ways.
Yeah. Okay. So can you advise listeners how they're best to go about finding a medical herbalist who's likely to be able to support them through cancer? It's quite specific, isn't it?
Well, if they're looking for a Western herb medicine specialist, so somebody who deals with herbs mainly from the European and American tradition, they can go to the College of Practitioners of Phytotherapy's website, which is www.phytotherapists.org. And I'm the president of the College of Practitioners of Phytotherapy, okay. So I have to plug them anyway. But we're a bunch of very, very highly trained herbalists who tend to be more interested in the researched herbs side of things. So we obviously pay attention to the traditional use and ethnobotanical use of herbs, because that's actually a central part of our tradition. But we also pay attention to the new research and make sure we use that as part of our practice. If patients are interested in other modalities, such as, you know, Ayurvedic traditional Chinese medicine or Tibetan medicine, I would expect a good place to go to see that would be the EHTPA website. So that's the European Herbal Traditional Medicine Practitioners Association, and that's, I think, www.ehtpa.eu. And on there, there's links to the different organisations within the EHTPA that are recommended, again, because they all sign up to a minimum standards of qualifications, so all university qualified.
Great. And lastly, just a question about the climate for herbalists. I know there's been a lot of stress coming from the EU for working with herbal medicines. How's that all going? Does it feel like you've still got enough room to wiggle to do what you need to do?
Oh God, that'd be another hour, I think, of talking there, Robin. As you probably all know, the UK government did recommend a couple of years ago to regulate herbal medicine. Then things went quiet with a change of government from Labour to Conservatives. And then the Conservatives decided for a third time to look at the case again, even though the previous two working groups had strongly suggested regulation. And the third working group suggested that herbal medicine was too safe, so therefore shouldn't be regulated. So we're currently stuck in a space where, even though herbal medicine, we know, is not safe, if it's used inappropriately, that the government doesn't seem to be wanting to do anything about it because of the expense. The issue with that is there are a lot of new courses springing up on the internet where you can do a weekend course in herbal medicine and call yourself a herbalist.
Right.
And of course, you know...
But you can't call yourself a medical herbalist.
Well, it's not a protected term.
It's not.
So anybody could call themselves... You could go and set up a shop and call yourself a medical herbalist. It's not a protected term like a doctor, because you have to be statutory regulated in order for that term to be protected.
Yes.
So that's the real issue.
Okay. So in a way, the lack of regulation is an issue for you, if anything.
It is.
But you're not feeling unduly restricted by other regulations about the use of herbs.
Well, not yet. We're kind of, with the changes to the EU Medicines Act, we're kind of living in a limbo world at the moment as herbalists, because we're not exactly covered by the law, but we're not exactly breaking the law either, which is why we would welcome a statutory regulation to put us firmly into protected legal side of things.
I understand.
So we are in limbo, we are a bit concerned, we don't know what's going on, quite frankly. The government was supposed to give a clear indication before Christmas about what was going to go ahead, way forward, and they've now decided to rethink and are going to come back to us later on this year. The problem is when I was training, this was supposed to be all sorted out in about 2002 or something like that. It's been lingering on for that long. And I can't see that it's going to be sorted out anytime soon.
No.
Which is a real, real shame.
Okay, but meanwhile, you've given us some reliable bodies you can go to find the real deal.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, Chris. Thanks very much for opening up, you know, what's a fascinating subject for us.
Oh, thank you, Robin, indeed. It's been very interesting for me as well. Thank you.
Herbal medicine has developed considerably in recent years, with the combination of global herbal resources and increased research,
making it an approach to treatment well worth considering. I do hope that Chris's deeply professional view of the subject has been helpful in bringing this option to the table for consideration. Please go to Yes to Life's website, that's yestolife.org.uk, click the link to the Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar and choose UK Health Radio to find links to the resources mentioned by Chris in the programme. Do please also check out my Facebook page and the monthly online Health Triangle magazine on the UK Health Radio website, in which Yes to Life has a regular feature. Next week, I'm off to Exeter to speak to Dr. Rajendra Sharma about his approach to supporting people with cancer. I hope you can join me again. Goodbye.